Shostakovich's Prelude and Fugue in G Major, played by Alexander Melnikov. Ending Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan, which is a unique production for BBC Radio 3. With studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
The brooding heart of jealousy.
Oh, beware, my lord of jealousy. It is the green-eyed monster.
The power of forbidden love.
1,000 times good night.
The hunger of a nation's pride.
Once more up to the breach, dear friends! Once more! Yeah!
How did one man capture all it is to be human? Shakespeare Unlocked. On TV, on radio, online, across the BBC.
This is BBC Radio 3 and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Caroline Quentin sprang into our collective consciousness as the much put-upon girlfriend Dorothy in Men Behaving Badly. Since then, there have been numerous stage appearances, lots of television, Jonathan Creek, three series of Life of Riley on BBC One, five of Blue Murder for ITV, and three of Life Begins. Written by Mike Bullen. He's somebody you particularly like working with, isn't he?
Yes. I think there's something about Michael's writing that people just tap into. They identify with it immediately, and it's warm and it's funny. And I think he writes very well for both men and women. And it's great for me to work with writers who really can, I think, give a voice to women of my generation.
You divide your time, really, between living in Devon with your family and then presumably being in London quite a lot of the time.
Filming, yeah, I do work in London still a lot. I also work in Glasgow and Manchester, and I think nowadays, really, you have to go where the work is. And because the BBC have moved out of town, we're all over the place all the time. So I can be based in Devon in a way as easily as I could be based in London. And I love it.
Reading through your list, Caroline, it strikes me that various pieces have rather punctuated your life in some ways. They're kind of signposts, almost.
I didn't realise until you asked me to put together the list quite how strongly some of this music has orchestrated my entire life. And it is quite a romantic soundtrack, I think, for my life. And it was interesting to see where the influences had come as well. I've enjoyed that process.
Do you feel that mirrors your personality?
Yes, I do. And I don't think it's something that perhaps people would know about me, particularly from my work.
The first piece, I think, probably takes you back to your mother in Canada.
My mother is French-Canadian. She's from Montreal. And I'm one of four girls. And I'm the youngest of four girls. And my mother, I say, was a very good person. She's still very much alive. She's 90 next year, but she's very much alive and very well. But she had a very bad stroke in the 1970s and was unable to play the piano after that stroke. But she was a very, very good classical pianist, my mother, really wonderful. And my earliest memories are of my mother playing, particularly Chopin, actually, but lots of different pieces. And this particular piece of music takes me right back to the drawing room of the house when I was a little girl, and my mother would either play it on the piano in the playroom, or we would go and listen to it on a big lacquer disc, you know, on the radio. I don't know, people won't know what I'm talking about. Some people, big, huge piece of walnut furniture, and you'd put this on, and whether it be this, or we used to play a lot of ballet music then, and lift the arm onto the crackly old record, and the cover was falling to bits, and it had been sellotaped, it had been played. Anyway, so my mother would put this on, and I would dance for her. I was 3 years old, I think, something like that. And I would dance around doing what I thought was very beautiful ballet for her, which I think was probably completely ludicrous, but she loved it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm back at Chart Lane Ballet School as well in Reigate, where I would have my dancing lessons. That encapsulates the mid-1960s for me.
That was a wonderful example of less is more, wasn't it? 56 seconds, but it said all it needed to.
It's breathtakingly beautiful, isn't it? And it's such a deep piece of music. I can see why it had an impact on a little girl, because it goes emotionally terribly deep, terribly simply. It's very wonderful, isn't it?
Did you learn to play the piano yourself?
Yes, I did. I did, and I still try at home. We have a piano and I do play, but I'm not very good. I mean, I read music, but I've never been the greatest pianist. But my children, both my daughter's a music scholar and my son started playing, and my dear husband, who has never played anything past his grade one last year. So we're all budding musicians.
Oh, full marks for effort. Vladimir Ashkenazy played the Prelude No. 7 and A Major Opus 28 by Chopin from the Preludes and Impromptus. How did you come to be an actress? Was it something you always wanted to do, or something that came almost serendipitously?
I didn't want to be an actress, really. I wanted to be a dancer, and I started ballet classes at 3, and I loved it. I was in love with the dance, and I went to a fantastic school for performing arts called Arts Educational School Training in Hertfordshire, and I was a dance scholar there. And we were very lucky. We'd learnt music, we did dance, we did drama, and that was my passion. And I went on to study contemporary dance later on when I went to London, but for various reasons I didn't finish my training. My family life was disrupted by various things, my mother's illness for one, and I had to earn a living. I had to go and I had to start earning a living. My parents are divorced and I needed to earn some money, and my mum was quite poorly. So rather than pursue a career in dance and to carry on with dance classes, I was found a job by the school. They got me a job in pantomime as one of the troupe of dancers. You know, we don't really see them much anymore, but they used to be troops of dancers at the end of the pier or in pantomimes. And you always had a row of six, depending on how wealthy the production was, 6, 8, 10 girls. This was a show with 4 girl dancers. It was at Luton Library Theatre and it was my first job. And it takes us directly to my next piece of music, because the ballet we did, that we did a little point work piece in the middle of, I think just before Cinderella went off to the ball, in this pantomime, we gave the little Waltz of the Flowers.
Thank you.
Great fun.
I can still remember the choreography. Mm. It was balancé, balancé, and then a turn. And that's 40 years later. It's wonderful, isn't it?
Those Russian composers really knew how to write music to dance to.
Yeah, it makes you want to dance. Mm.
That was The Waltz of the Flowers from the Nutcracker, Opus 71 by Tchaikovsky. And we heard the orchestra of the Royal Opera House conducted by Mark Ermler. So did this Luton performance, Caroline, lead to great things?
No, it led to unemployment for many years. And I used to do a panto and a summer season every year for years. And I really thought I was going to have to start to look for other work, to find another job. And then I realised I can't do anything else. And it was a really shocking revelation. I suddenly thought, oh no, I'm really going to have to make a go of this. I'm going to have to find something in the theatre, in the arts. I'm going to have to do it because I can't do maths. I can't give change of a pound. I have no secretarial skills, and I did try. So that was a very slow beginning, really. And it took me 10, maybe 12 years to kind of get momentum going, really.
And was there something that sort of was the key to the door?
I did a play at a pub theatre, the Old Red Lion, and it was a fringe piece, and I sang in it and I danced in it and I acted in it. And there was a casting director from the Royal Court Theatre, and I auditioned for a part in a Nigel Williams play, and that was a sort of one of my beginnings. I mean, I went to the National Theatre from there and did bits at the National Theatre. I did a play at the Royal Court. Then I had another huge hiatus and I was out of work for a long time, and I went to Les Miserables. I was in the original cast of that at the Barbican Theatre. And somewhere in there, television happened, and I went into, I think, Men Behaving Badly. I did some costume dramas and things, but Men Behaving Badly sort of happened during that process. Yeah. And I think that's when my television career certainly gathered momentum.
It is extraordinary and in a way almost frightening, isn't it, the way television can have that power.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's the same now, but when
so
you have
many channels, yeah.
I think that's right. It's different. Yeah. I mean, at one point, I think with Men Behaving Badly, I think one show got 18 million viewers, 18 million people, and you know, and I'd basically been a hoofer and a singer and a warbler, and then suddenly I was in this massively successful. And it is life altering.
Was it enjoyable to do at the time?
Oh yeah, I mean, I laughed. I laughed for 8 years of my life. I enjoyed my fellow actors. We loved working on the scripts. Simon Nye's scripts were wonderful. Beryl Virtue, our producer, Martin Clunes, Neil, we were really good friends and we had a great time.
The next piece, Caroline Quentin, I think had quite an important effect on you when you heard it.
Yeah, this is Canteloube and it's the Songs of the Auvergne, and I was taken by a friend, I was in my early 20s, to St John Smith Square, and I heard these songs for the first time and I'd never heard anything like them. I'd never heard anything like them. And I found them so haunting. It was almost a surreal experience. I can remember leaving feeling as if I had been through a life-changing experience musically. And I have adored them ever since. I'm trying to learn to sing them at the moment. And of course, I'm not an opera singer, so I make the most terrible noise. But I'm just really loving trying to piece the songs together.
What's wonderful about them is that in their kind of use of the folk tradition, they have a kind of earthiness and naturalness, which I think is what is so infectious. But of course, they're also just lovely melodies.
Well, I think if you're, you know, you're saying I live in the countryside, I live in Devon, I love the countryside, it's important to me. And I think these go to the very heart of what it is to know a rural existence. And you can hear it. There's a truth there about living in nature with animals. There's an honesty and a directness to that. And I think that's what I probably was touched by unknowingly at the time.
That would lull any baby to sleep, I think. And it is, in fact, a lullaby, Brezzarola. She's trying to get a child to fall asleep and does succeed by the end.
You can hear the love in it.
That was Canteloube's Brezzarola from the Chant d'Auvergne, and we heard Véronique Jean with the Orchestre National de Lille, conducted by Jean-Claude Cassadessous. We're going to another, I think, what you might call ethereal piece now, a piece that has sort of great magic in it, literally, and in the sound world it conjures up, Caroline.
I came to this very recently, and I was taken to Glyndebourne a couple of years ago by a friend of mine, Hugh, and he said, we're going to see Britain's A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I thought, well, that's okay, I love Britain, and I know the play, and so good, I'm in with a start, I'm not going to be baffled, nothing's going to kind of, sometimes I go and it's, oh, I don't know what's happening. I think this is one of the most exciting pieces of music I've ever heard. I love Benjamin Britten, and I find a lot of these, the things I'm talking about, really, they are so unique, you can't imagine hearing anything like it in your life. There's so of itself. And this moment in A Midsummer Night's Dream, You Spotted Snakes, I almost leapt out of my chair with excitement because I got a huge wave of excitement through my body. I think my husband said I squeaked. I kind of made a squeaking. Squeaking. But it's a magical play. And I think this music is truly magical.
It's a wonderful test, isn't it, to take a Shakespeare play and to at least equal it, if nothing more, and perhaps even to add to it.
Well, I think add to it, and I think that's what's so extraordinary, because for the audience or the listener, you believe in the magic of it in a way that I suspect people would have done when they first saw the play. We are suddenly truly bewitched by the music, I think.
Oh,
There's sort of magical mischief afoot there. You spotted snakes with double tongue from Act One of Benjamin Britten's A Midsummer Night's Dream. We heard the Trinity Boys Choir and the City of London Symphonia, conducted by the late and much missed Richard Hickox. Caroline, you mentioned when we heard... Actually, I was just thinking we had two lullabies for the price of one.
I know, I just realised that, yeah.
But I was going to say, you mentioned earlier how, in a sense, the first Tchaikovsky piece you had, The Waltz of the Flowers, came at a sort of time of some disrupt. And I think it's true to say that's slightly why the next bit of Tchaikovsky means quite a lot to you, because it was also a difficult time.
This violin concerto helped me through a divorce, and you know, quite a public divorce.
Paul Merton, wasn't
with Paul Merton, yeah. And I had never experienced anything quite like it. And I was working in Australia, and this was one of the pieces of music I took with me. And I was terribly, terribly unhappy at the time. And I honestly believe this helped me through that period.
It's sort of cathartic, the music.
It is, and it ranges so widely emotionally. I think that's right. I think the catharsis comes because you are allowed that journey. And if you are feeling vulnerable and sad and lost, I think, you know someone else has been there before you. There's something about, there's a support in it and a camaraderie and a feeling that you're not alone in that. I cannot express myself very well.
Yes,
but
no, because you know, I think you're absolutely, I mean, these Russian composers like Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff too, seemed to know and touch an area of desolation that we can all relate to. And it's certainly true that they're composers that wear their hearts on their sleeves.
Yeah.
And I think that probably connects with people.
I think that's right. I mean, it's true you say that, because I feel very much about, with Chekhov, I feel exactly the same. There is an immediacy of emotion, an understanding of the depth of human sadness and also vanity. I think we recognise that when we hear Tchaikovsky, in the way that we recognise it when we see The Seagull or Three Sisters. It allows us to feel that we're allowed, we are given permission to feel those things.
And of course, in a violin concerto, as we have here, you have a protagonist against the orchestra, or sometimes with the orchestra. But so there is the lone voice, if you like, fighting and riding the waves.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And I love Nigel Kennedy playing this piece because it is so raw. And I think it's superb the way he plays this. It really touches me so very deeply. I adore it.
Thank you. The extraordinary thing about that performance in particular, I think, Caroline, is that, and given what you were saying earlier, this is interesting, it's melancholic, certainly, it's noble at times, very exciting, picks up the pace, doesn't it, in the middle. So it's not actually sentimental.
It's optimistic. It is not remotely sentimental. It's actually brutally emotional. I don't think it's saccharine at all. I think it's quite brutal, very funny. I find some of it genuinely playing with the rhythms, comedic. I mean, really funny and hugely moving, touchy. I mean, I can't think of an emotion that isn't covered by it. And in the end, it's optimistic. And I think that's what I really love. It does everything.
Music from the first movement of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto in D, Opus 35. Nigel Kennedy playing the violin with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Oko Kamu. I don't know whether you knew this or not, Caroline, but Tchaikovsky worshipped Mozart, and Britain worshipped both Tchaikovsky and Mozart. So you've had they would have approved of this progression in your choice.
I didn't know that, and I'm thrilled.
And it's to the overture from The Marriage of Figaro, Caroline Quentin, yes, that you're going to have next.
Yes. I first saw this, again, takes me back to Glyndebourne, and I was dating, actually, a stage manager at Glyndebourne, and he said, do you want to come? I've got some free tickets. I was 18 years old. And I said, oh, all right, I don't know what I'm going to wear, and I didn't have any, and I didn't know, I went out, bought myself something new, and went into the theatre, sat down, didn't know this opera at all, and I found this overture so exciting, I could barely sit in my seat. And I have to tell you, I'm exactly the same now. It hasn't altered a bit. Whenever I hear it, I get hugely excited. I can't wait for the story to start. I can't wait to hear them counting, measuring. I still find it does exactly that to me now. And for me, it's just what theatre is about. You know, it's the real joy of it. When it grabs you and you get so full of energy and excitement and you can't wait for it to start.
It seizes you by the throat from the very first semiquavers, doesn't it?
Immediately. I've got goosebumps just even thinking about it.
Thank you.
Well, you know you're in for a good night out, don't you?
It's a wonderful opening. It was one of the most joyous, exuberant openings I can think of. And, of course, the interesting thing about that opera, like Così fan tutte too, is that Mozart has a kind of Shakespearean understanding of human frailty.
Yeah, and of love and of arrogance and of, yeah, it's all laid out in that overture. You have a taste of everything you're going to get.
The overture from The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart, played by the Glyndebourne Festival Orchestra, conducted by Vittorio Gui. Now, Caroline Quentin, you talked about human frailty there, and I suspect you're something of a rugby widow on occasion.
I am at the moment, oddly enough. I am. I think that's very perceptive of you. My husband, Sam, well, was a very keen rugby player. My son, he's 8, William, is a very keen rugby player. So my daughter and I have to amuse ourselves for quite long periods of time when the rugby's going on. But I'm lucky in as much as I have learnt to love rugby through my menfolk.
But when your husband is not playing rugby, he sometimes does something a little more delicate, like learning the guitar?
Yep. As I said, we're all aspiring musicians in my house, and my husband is learning the piano and the classical guitar. My son, who's 8, is learning the classical guitar and the trombone. And
so you're aware of that in the house?
He's just given up the violin, I'm thrilled to say. My daughter is a music scholar and plays the flute and the piano. And my husband and my son spend a lot of time comparing notes on the guitar, literally comparing notes.
Well, we're going to hear quintessential Spanish guitar classical writing. This is a Granados piece. Is it one that you've heard in the house?
Yes, Sam and I both love this piece of music. And what this piece of music is for me is family life. My husband and my son and my daughter and music and warm evenings looking over the hills, over the water. And life doesn't get any better than this, really, for me.
Thank you. Segovia was playing Danza Triste, his arrangement of the Spanish dance, Opus 37, number 10, by Granados. Well, thank you very much, Caroline Quentin. Are we going to lose you entirely to Devon in the forthcoming months, or will we be seeing you in something else soon?
I am about to start work with Stephen Polyakov on a very interesting new drama, six-part drama called Dancing on the Edge, which is set in London in the 1930s and is about jazz clubs and jazz music. So I'm very, very excited about that.
So you might be going back to your origins in that case.
Yeah.
A little bit of hoofing.
I do hope so. I'm actually playing the owner of a jazz club, and she's quite a saucy lady, so she might kick her heels off.
And will this be BBC, ITV?
BBC One.
Yeah. We look forward to that. Caroline Quentin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Caroline Quentin was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the landscape artist Keith Grant. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Sarah Cropper.
The case for doubt.
Doubt is a glorious reminder of our limitations as human beings, of how little we can ever know, and it comes in black, of how suspicious and it comes we should always be of certainty. And I'm frightened by those who don't see it. At my convent boarding school, we grew up with doubt, capitalized, like God.
The Essay, including contributions by Susan Greenfield.
Doubt in science is integral, not so much to what scientists do, but to how we think.
And Alistair Campbell.
Did they just say Alistair Campbell? What does he know about self-doubt?
The Essay, The Case for Doubt. Weeknights this week at 10:45 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, the time now is just after 1 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's time now for the news with David Cornett.
A peace plan brokered by the international envoy Kofi Annan to end the conflict in Syria has run into trouble 2 days before it's due to come into effect. The Syrian Foreign Ministry has said the government won't withdraw its forces from towns and cities unless opposition groups give written guarantees to stop the fighting. Anti-government activists say that as many as 160 people died yesterday on one of the bloodiest days of the Syrian uprising. Activists say many of the deaths were in the western city of Hama, which has been shelled by government forces. The Pope has used his Easter Sunday message to urge the Syrian regime to end bloodshed and to commit to dialogue. The Vatican says he'll visit Lebanon for 3 days in September on his second foreign trip this year. In his last Easter message before he stands down, the Archbishop of Canterbury also touched on the Middle East, saying that the daily harassment and humiliation of Palestinians at Israeli checkpoints can't be a justifiable price to pay for security. Government ministers have condemned the hacking group Anonymous, which claims to have launched an online attack on the Home Office website. The site was disrupted for several hours last night, but it's now operating normally. Anonymous says it took the action in protest at government extradition and surveillance policies. A man has been charged with a public order offence after yesterday's university boat race was disrupted by a protester. Trenton Oldfield will appear before magistrates later this month. A cruise ship, which will follow the same route as that of the Titanic, sets sail from Southampton this afternoon, almost exactly 100 years after the ship hit an iceberg and sank. The MS Balmoral will carry more than 1,300 people, including scores of relatives of those who died in the disaster. And the weather, it'll be rather cloudy with outbreaks of rain and drizzle, particularly across southeast England and some western areas. Heavier rain will reach the northwest later today and will spread southeast overnight. BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
Read by David Cornett. I'm Jill Anderson. Good afternoon to you. At 2 o'clock this afternoon, our Sunday concert will be given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Davis. There are two works in their programme. First of all, Hugh Wood's violin concerto, and Anthony Marwood will be the violin soloist. And then we'll hear a performance of Michael Tippett's A Child of Our Time. The vocal soloists will be Nicole Cabell, Karen Cargill, John Mark Ainsley and Matthew Rose with the BBC Symphony Chorus. That's our Sunday concert starting at 2 o'clock. But now it's time to join Lucy Skeeping for a seasonal early music show.
joyful Kyrie to open today's programme. Rather Vivaldi-ish, wasn't it? But no, it's not remotely Venetian, or even Italian for that matter. It's by a composer from further north, Willem de Fes, part of his Easter Mass for Antwerp Cathedral in 1730, and possibly written as some kind of peace offering because just a few months earlier, poor old de Fes had fallen out with the church authorities. He continued to have quite a dodgy relationship with the cathedral, but for now at least, all was forgiven and he was paid handsomely for his work. Well, in keeping with the season, we're featuring music for Easter all through today's early music show. The story of the betrayal, the trial and crucifixion of Jesus has inspired composers to create some of their most personal and reflective works. In ancient times, the Passion would simply be chanted by a single voice. By the Middle Ages, three priests would deliver the text, one singing the narrative, one the words of Christ, and the third providing the voices of the crowd. With the Renaissance came harmony and four-part choruses, and eventually instruments would colour the text as well, along with chorales, which the congregation would join in, so that they themselves could literally become part of the story. For the next piece, we're in the Sicilian town of Palermo. The year is 1714, and one Francesco Scarlatti, the younger brother of the better-known Alessandro, is frantically putting the finishing touches to a new work. He'd been a member of the orchestra at the Royal Court in Naples, but now in his mid-twenties and married, he'd returned to his hometown, where his Miserere would be given at the Easter service. It's such lovely music that it's hard to imagine just why his efforts as a composer weren't fully appreciated during his lifetime. From the imperial court in Vienna to the English household of Handel's one-time employer, the Duke of Chandos, this Scarlatti was passed over again and again for the jobs he sought. Nevertheless, this Miserere certainly is a glorious contribution to the Easter repertoire. And we'll hear the final section, Gloria Patri.